Hello, everyone, and welcome. The gaming industry potentially holds important business lessons for many other kinds of industries or product areas. And in fact, gaming has been the lead in driving platforms like home computing, VR, mobile applications, and innovative consumer business models like free-to-play. So today we are joined by Ludovic Bodin, who has basically a 20-year experience in tech and gaming globally. He was early in social games and free-to-play games with the largest Unity games on browser and Facebook, a social shooter called UberStrike. I remember those games very fondly, Ludovic. You then shifted to investment around 4 years ago, and you've already had a couple of unicorns, I believe, in your investment portfolio. And aside from other things, I think you are most recently the author of Atomic Scaling, which is the focus of our discussion today, in which he shares with us his journey leading to this book, and really where he talks about how small teams can create huge growth and trying to take this topic that I mentioned before, applying the lessons learned from the games industry and from gaming to other areas. Thanks for joining us. Welcome, Ludovic.
Thanks for having me, Joseph.
So I thought I'd just start with like the whole, this thesis, right? Why do you think it is that gaming has lessons for other industries? And what kind of was the origin story behind your motivation to write this book?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the origin story for me actually starts around 2013. It was in January 2013. So at that time, I own a video game company, as you said. We were doing like shooters and so on. We had studio. We have studio in Asia. We have investor in Silicon Valley, and I'm traveling a lot back and forth between Asia and Silicon Valley and doing a lot of fundraising. And that particular day in January 2013, it's a Tuesday, and I'm in Finland. I'm in Helsinki. It's very cold. It's like 8:30 in the morning, and I'm about to meet one man for the first time. We're having breakfast downstairs of his building, and this man is also the CEO of a video game company. He just launched his mobile game about 6 months ago, and I know at that time already that he's on his way to be big, to be a billionaire or so. And that man here on my left is actually Hilka. Hilka Panaman, the CEO of Supercell. So Hilka is wearing his jeans, like with his black t-shirts with the Supercell logo on it. And we exchange a few words, and very quickly, even if it's the first time we meet, I feel very at ease with him, and I start sharing with him how I feel. So I'm explaining to him that our game is growing and we're hiring a lot of people and we're raising funds, but I had one specific problem is like the more people I add to the team, the less productive I feel our team is, and also the more pressure I feel both on the financial and
just
emotional.
For our audience, Ludovic, you're saying predictive and not productive, right?
Productive, sorry.
Productive. Okay.
Yeah.
Good. Okay. Sorry.
Yeah. Predictive also.
Yeah. Well, we can talk about that because I did read parts of the book. So yeah, but please go ahead.
So the team is getting bigger and bigger, and my problem is not getting solved basically. And I mean, you're an entrepreneur, and part of your audience, if they are entrepreneur, they probably know the feeling. Like I feel like kind of running into a circle. Just the bigger team, more and more financial pressure. But, you know, my problem is not getting solved. And I pause and I basically look at Hilka, and then Hilka say, why don't you stop hiring and instead focus on your existing team? And I pause and then why don't you stop hiring and instead focus on your existing team? And then he starts to explain to me Supercell, and he basically, you know, which is on his logo on his t-shirts, and he's basically saying that his team at Supercell, while developing game, are usually 3 to 5 people, and his objective is to keep the team as small as possible for as long as possible, while growing successfully as much as possible, and that was very much kind of the first seed in my mind. And fast forward, when I became investor a few years later, I have to decide in which company and which team I want to invest. And I over the years, I see many more companies succeeding, and I realize this importance of this first principle, kind of keep the team as small as possible for as long as possible. And this kind of became a mantra for me, and ultimately culminating into the creation of Atomic Scaling. So stay as small as possible for as long as possible, that the atomic part, while growing, you know, financially as much as possible, that's the scaling part.
Got it.
That was the first seed and how I started working on Atomic Scaling.
Oh, that's great to hear. And just for our audience, I have actually run the numbers on kind of revenue per employee for a number of gaming studios in the world. And Supercell is absolutely one of the highest in terms of revenue per employee. I mean, Ubisoft's kind of at the bottom, but they do an incredible job. And so it kind of sounds like what happened is that you have been talking to various game industry experts. You have a background in gaming yourself. And based upon those lessons learned, maybe they were kind of germinating inside of your head. And then when you shifted to become an investor, you were trying to create a framework for yourself. And tell me if I'm right or wrong on this, but it sounds like you were creating this framework for yourself, or how are you able to kind of create this kind of way of thinking about successful companies based upon your experiences in the gaming industry and talking to these leading game industry experts. Would that be fair to say, Ludovic?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, Ilka planted this idea in my mind in 2018, but it kind of was in my mind and stayed there. When I start writing Atomic Scaling, that's at the beginning of COVID, and I was basically already like a full-time investor and starting to do pretty well. I got indeed two unicorns pretty quickly in my portfolio, which was nice. But actually, the idea of Atomic Scaling came from someone else, and from another gaming guy, and that's actually also a gaming entrepreneur who has around 350 employees. Mega hit game. He has a few very good game and one very big PC platform game. Yeah, and as you said, his company is actually the most profitable company per employee in USA, in front of Apple and Google and Microsoft and so on. He's based in Seattle, and he's a bit of a legend in the gaming industry. He's a founder of Valve with games like Counter-Strike and Dota and Steam, obviously. So that's Gabe. So Gabe, at the beginning of COVID, kind of threw something at me that's kind of like, wow, it was a bit of... He basically said, just this simple idea that the sets of lessons we learn in the video game business will be true of a much wider range of industry tomorrow. But no one yet has shared the lesson learned from the video game business and how this can apply to a much wider range of industry. So it was kind of an epiphany for me. And I was at the beginning of my new life as an investor. I was looking to kind of formalize my investment thesis, and it became my call. So I wanted to make an impact and share the lessons we learned in the video game business, not just for the people within the gaming industry, but also for the people outside of the gaming industry. Beginning of COVID, you know, everything was going online. Gaming industry was doing great. Everyone started to kind of notice it because we were 100% online, and other people suddenly had to shift. And that's how it all happened.
Got it. And I want to say, like, I was actually going through the book and going through some of your endorsements. So you are quite, I would have to say that the endorsements for this book are just incredible, right? And so from Peter Vesterbacka from Rovio, Ilka, Kevin Lin, co-founder of Twitch, Gabe Newell, who you mentioned, there are like, so I could go on and on, but like the endorsements have been pretty crazy. How did you meet these guys? How did you build such an incredible network in the gaming industry and be able to speak to these guys to be able to learn some of the insights that you have used in your book?
Yeah, I mean, I've been in the gaming industry and the tech industry for a while, and travel a lot. So Asia, where I'm based half of the time, I'm from Europe, and
right?
And spent a lot of time in USA, close to 10 years. I think like one of the reasons why people also are excited about this is like people want to share, and everybody right. knows that the gaming industry is doing extremely well, and we actually share between each other. Everyone, I think, in the gaming industry is very generous, but we kind of live in this bubble. And I think with COVID, at least for me, that was really like kind of this big shock. Like I had investment in gaming industry, I had investment outside of gaming industry. I knew right. my companies that are 100% focused online are going to do amazingly well. But I had also stress about the company where to suddenly go from 5% online to 10%, 20%, 100% online. So I think that's a reason like people want to share and want to share beyond the gaming industry.
Right. And I hear that is something kind of specific to the Finnish gaming culture as well, right? Where they like to share a lot. And I know in your book, you do talk about kind of the difference between finite and infinite games, not so much from the perspective of zero sum versus infinite games, but in other aspects. But to this point, I do think that's one great thing about our industry is that there are so many people who aren't seeing each other so much as competition, but wanting to help each other and to help the industry grow. And I do think that based upon some of the things that I saw in your book, I would highly recommend folks to check it out because there is certainly a lot of wisdom from a lot of the folks who you spoke to. And so I kind of understand how you kind of came about with the idea for the book and kind of the thesis behind it. But then what was your motivation as well to actually write the, is it to share with more folks broadly about, hey guys, this is the games industry. This shouldn't be a secret. This can be applied to many other industries. What was the specific motivation to write the book?
Yeah, you're exactly right. Like the first motivation was to share this collective wisdom, not just with the people within the gaming industry, but with the people outside of the gaming industry. And I wanted to also have this ability as an investor to read and to basically formalize my investment thesis. But as an entrepreneur, I also wanted to create this kind of navigation system where you basically have this like big principle from the gaming industry that make the gaming industry so successful today. And you try to kind of apply that to outside of the gaming industry, not just within the gaming industry, but also outside of the gaming industry.
Certainly, if the book does well, it could help increase your reputation. We're living in a reputation-driven world at this point, or like the social media influence world. So maybe that would also help you with your investment business. Was that also a motivation?
Yeah, it's also, you know, it's also a way to kind of attract the right company that you want to partner. I mean, the more the companies are aligned with atomic scaling principle, the easier for me it is to give a go and want to invest money and network and support and time and so on to these companies.
Right. And so I think the kind of crux of the book or the kind of framework that you're describing is what you call the 3 P's, 3 R's framework.
Yep.
People, prediction, playbook, revenue, yep. reach, retention. And I thought maybe we could just kind of briefly, I mean, I think I would highly recommend the audience to get the book and to check it out on their own. But just to give the audience kind of like a high level understanding of the topics that you cover, could we walk through the 3 P's, 3 R's, and then how did, maybe you could even give us a little bit of backstory behind how you came to this specific framework of 3 P's and 3 R's.
Yeah, absolutely. So the people part, you know, start with this first principle, which is to keep the team as small as possible for as long as possible. That's really like the atomic part of it. And within this first principle, I basically deconstruct like how do you actually create small team that are extremely capable and have extraordinary output. And around that, there is multiple ideas that we go through that I'm not going to go into details before, but we talk, for example, about this ability to go from left brain to right brain, this ability to create this magical pair, and all the trust aspects behind the team and so on. But maybe before I address this, like, because there is a bit of elephant in the room when I talk to people about atomic scaling, is if we want to keep the team as small as possible for as long as possible, like, what does it mean for the employees of the companies who are actually going to adopt atomic scaling? A lot of them by default are like, oh, okay, that means we're going to start like firing people and having less and less people. That means we're not going to hire people, et cetera, et cetera. So the kind of the elephant in the room here is like, we're not there with, there is the old way of scaling, and the old way of scaling is like, you grow and you just hire more and more people and you become bigger and bigger and bigger. I've personally seen time and time again the damage to companies and friends running this company, and some of them with quite a dramatic outcome. And when the bubble burst, and it always does, the fall is extremely painful and dangerous. On the other end, you have like all this traditional company, like I call them kind of the fat company, that the one with maybe big revenue, big workforce, and maybe even pretty good profit. And this company today clearly at risk of disruption from company who are adopting AI, adopting the atomic scaling principle, and so on. Here with atomic scaling, we're not trying to kind of, it's not like a job killer. It's like the idea of it's more about having, instead of a large team working on one project, it's about having multiple small team, like cells, work like cells in organism, working on smaller and smaller and more focused project. So from there, like, we basically want to give more ownership to employees, but also more benefits to the employees. We're encouraging to feel more empowered, to have greater trust between the people, to work better together, and also to reward financially much greatly than the traditional model.
Yeah. And I did read that part of the book, which I thought was great. And again, I would highly recommend the audience to get the book and to read some of those concepts there. But maybe I could also push back a little bit or ask for a clarification. Because the general themes that you talk about in terms of empowerment, you talk about like the supercell notion of a reverse pyramid in the book, for example. Yeah. And I actually think that it's quite fair, some of the notions you talk about in terms of like sharing some of the outcomes of employees that actually deliver better results. But I also think in some cases there are, for example, so Steve Jobs was famous for a quote in which he mentioned that the best employees don't need to be managed. And I believe that to be true, that there are certain employees, the people part, where you have people who are really great, who are overachievers. Steve Jobs talked about Woz being a 30X engineer, but that's not necessarily the mindset of all people, right? And so there may be people in a company who don't have that mindset. And for example, I started a company in India, and just for our audience, Ludovic's an investor in my company as well. But like, the historical context in India has been a services-oriented company. Tell me the job, I do the job, I finish the job, I go home. And so in that context, do you think it's, is it only certain companies with those kinds of people, like the Steve Jobs kind of people, who can take advantage of some of these principles? Or how would you create an organization to get those kinds of people who can move the needle in that way to empower those people? Because some people, even if you empower them, they're basically going to be like, well, I don't know what to do. Tell me what to do. And then once they do their job, they're going to be like, okay, I'm done. I'm going to go home. I don't know what else. Like, that mindset has not been taught to them, for example. And just wondering how you think about situations like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the first things is to look at the size of the team. Like, if okay. With atomic scaling, we're trying to keep team that are like pizza size type of team, like a small team, like 3, 5, 7 people, like a type.
Right.
So if the team is much smaller, you basically suddenly start to see a lot more who is doing what, basically.
There's a lot more transparency. The flaws become very visible at that point. I see what you're saying.
Exactly. The second point is we focus on a magical pair. So if you have a small team, but if you don't have a magical pair on leading the team, there is a good chance that the team is not as performant as it could be. And magical pair, within the magical pair, you have like this leadership happening. So you don't necessarily have one boss out of the two, but you have these two people constituting the magical pair that basically become somehow the management force or the leadership force of the company. Not necessarily playing the boss, but they're actually driving the direction. So if first step, the team, instead of being a big team, meaning more than 7 or 8 people, if it's a smaller team, like 3, 5, 7 people, suddenly it's a lot easier to manage. And second thing, if you actually have a magical pair leading that, suddenly there is actually leadership. There is some kind of management.
Right. And I think the next P, we mentioned prediction versus production. I think I was kind of preempting you because I did look through your book, but could you talk about what you mean by prediction?
Yeah, prediction, like we're talking about this idea of PvP. So not player versus player, but prediction versus prophecy. So prediction is something that you actually, you have a set of hypotheses and you actually measure. You measure your set of hypotheses. You see basically your hypothesis versus reality. Like Zynga probably is one of the company who kind of brought this to the gaming industry at the level where we are right now. Like this ability to constantly have hypotheses and constantly look at your hypotheses and measure versus what's happening right now as you are developing the game, as you're actually running the games in live ops and so on. So the first thing that we look at on the prediction part, we also have like 4 principles within that, is actually how you actually give back the power of prediction to the people. Like if you go to most company, like gaming company and traditional company, like non-gaming company, most people don't know how to predict. Most people have not been taught how to predict. You don't really learn how to predict at school or at universities and so on. It's not something that we've been taught. So the first thing is like, okay, everyone here has the capability to make prediction. We encourage everyone to make prediction, and we're going to teach people how to make a prediction. Within the prediction part, we actually go through Twitch, who has been really famous within the industry to empower the people to make more prediction, and also using like mathematical kind of prediction and teaching people how to predict. And since they got bought by Amazon, this also kind of, you know, really match well the culture of Amazon. Then once we actually agree on the fact that we should bring back the power of prediction to people, and we should start teaching to people, we also teach people not only to predict, but how to differentiate prediction versus prophecy. Prophecy is typically what happens in a meeting where people start to say, okay, we should increase by, you know, 20% of revenue, or we should increase by 5% of our activation rate, or we should do this, or we should do that. And there is no measurement there, and people tend to just follow who has a louder voice in the meeting. So prophecy is not a bad thing. It's actually necessary as you come up with hypotheses. You look at gut feeling, you look at benchmark and stuff like that, but you need to start to be able to differentiate the PvP, the prediction versus the prophecy, and start shifting prophecy toward prediction. And you do that, and we go through how Gabe also at Valve recommends this cycle. You go through the cycle of hypothesis, measurement, and change. And the faster you are at this, the better, the more productive your company become. Gabe has actually a quote that I really like, that I use quite a lot in my workshops and in this chapter. He said, predictions matter as much as production. So prediction matter as much as production. The ability to predict, to make proper hypothesis, measure, change quickly, and basically have your hypothesis match in reality as quickly as possible, is actually more powerful than the production capability. And also take example of traditional company like LVMH, like the French luxury company. Right. Everybody thinks LVMH is really good on the right part of the brain, you know, like the creative part and so on, which is true. They have very good designers, and they bought a very expensive company with very good designers and so on. But actually the core of LVMH and the core of Bernard Arnault, who is actually an engineer from the top engineering school from France, Polytechnique. The core of Bernard Arnault, a little bit like Jeff Bezos, is his capability to make prediction and to have all his subsidiaries, because it's actually all fairly small team within the LVMH group, being really good at prediction. And the result of that is they have almost zero waste. If they produce a luxury bag, the luxury bag gets sold. And they don't do discount and they don't do this because okay. they're really, really good at knowing what they should produce based on their capability to predict.
And Ludovic, when it comes to prediction, how wide or how broad is the scope of prediction that you would recommend for a company? So for example, Zynga is famous for expected outcomes, which is largely product driven, right? So we introduce this feature, we think this change will have this impact. And so from a product perspective, I can totally see it absolutely makes sense. You should be trying to predict those kinds of things related to product production, a number of handbags that we're going to sell, things like that. But then internally, and not necessarily product or manufacturing oriented, do you also apply predictions within the organization and the company itself? Or would you just apply it mainly to like product outcomes, for example?
Yeah, some of the example we take with Twitch, for example, and that's while we're writing the book, we're also running workshop to with gaming and non-gaming company to test the materials and so on. And one thing that really resonates with a lot of companies is how to apply prediction also to your production capability. For example, if you're developing a software, encouraging your engineers to come up with prediction on how many days it's going to take to develop this or that features. And once you actually ask this, ask them like what percentage chance do you think it's going to, if the engineer say, oh, I think it's going to take 3 days to develop this feature, then ask the question, what percentage chance do you think it's actually going to be complete within 3 days? Well, and that's actually some of the example we take with Twitch. Well, maybe 60%. Okay, so that's 60%. That's not 100%. That's not 80%. So why 60%? And then you actually go back through back and forth and you realize that maybe it's not a 3 days prediction, but maybe it's actually a 4 days or 5 days. And it's much better to have this conversation early on and have high confidence that this will happen within 5 days, for example, rather than just get the answer from the engineer, I'll do it because the boss said we should do it quickly. So encouraging people to have this conversation back and forth, put mathematical hypothesis like 80% chance and so on to kind of have this back and forth conversation is something that Twitch encouraged and got really good at, and Valve and other companies.
Yeah. And I know like for engineers, like doing time estimates for engineering tasks is something that's controversial. Some like it, some don't. But I think that to your point, at least if you start having a conversation about why 3 hours versus 5 hours or half a day versus a full day or whatever, then you can start to think more critically about it. And I can certainly see that, for example, it could be applied to other kinds of disciplines and processes, right? So for example, you might have a certain HR or recruitment process, or you have by adding a written test or changing who the interviewer is, what do we think the probability of making a successful hire or a high performing hire is, or things like that? I can see that being potentially applied to many other areas, but I'm just not having done that practice in terms of trying to predict those things. I do think that it's worth reading the cases in your book where it has been applied and understanding how it has been successfully applied by companies like Zynga, in at least from a product perspective, and to try and at least think about where else can we apply these kinds of principles of prediction to help benefit the company in some ways.
Yeah, and we also took the example of Voodoo, the hyper-casual game developer. Like one of the things that I think one of the big revolution that happened fairly recently with the hyper-casual game was the fact that we could test an idea by running Facebook ads very, very quickly before actually really investing in making the games. And I think it applied to many things. Like when when I wrote the book, for example, like I need to take a while to write a book, like seven different manuscripts, editor, publisher, you know, a lot of back and forth and so on.
Did you predict how long it would take you?
Well, I had a very bad prediction. That was more prophecy back then, yeah. And one of the reasons is I it's actually my third book, but it's actually the first book that will pass the finish line and being fully published. The book is actually going out next month. It's going out actually for GDC, so in March. Yeah, so one of the way to reduce also the risk is as you're actually writing the book or as you're developing the game, well, you have beta testers. That means you actually test your content with other writers, with companies, gaming, non-gaming, and the content change a lot by doing that.
Right. So I guess one of the other aspects of prediction that you're promoting is this notion of like testing and iterating very, very rapidly.
Yeah, that's the quicker you do it, the better. Yeah, I mean, especially in gaming industry, it's been a little bit better in the last few years, but it's so easy, and I've done it multiple times as a game entrepreneur. Like it's so easy to have an idea and think this idea is going to be the best, and
absolutely,
you start working on it, and suddenly you enter the tunnel, and you think it's going to take 6 months, and 2 years later you're still working on it. And it's
tell
and
me
you're
that.
Like. I mean, been there, done that, and yeah. lost air in yeah. No, that's so. Yeah, the quicker you do that, the better. And I actually invested in a few fintech company, and some of my favorite investments where I spent quite a bit of time with is actually algo trading company, and I just love algo trading company because they come up with an idea, and within days they have the idea tested, and if it works, well, you start printing money basically, and you can see in real time your hypothesis versus reality, which the reality actually are the trade, the hypothesis is your win rate and so on, and this is beautiful. Like if you have almost no intermediary between your assumption and the market.
Right. And the third P is playbook.
Yeah, playbook, we talk a lot about alignment, and we talk about play to win, and we talk about like different things, but maybe it's kind of share like the idea of playbook. I'm going to maybe like just share a story that maybe illustrate this.
Please.
The idea of playbook and alignment. So I was actually not that long ago, I was at the park with my daughter, with Mia, and with my oldest daughter. And we basically meet a friend, and very quickly I told them, hey guys, like why don't you start playing with the ball? So I throw them the ball and they start playing. So you have one kid who is like kicking as hard as possible the ball, another one who grabbed the ball with the hand, start chasing the other and throwing and trying to tag the other kid, and very quickly everyone is exhausted, and boom, suddenly you got one kid who got hit in the face and game over. Like kids start to cry, and it's so I go and I basically look at the damage, I look at the kid, and then I realize, oh yeah. So I told the kid, hey, why don't we actually play soccer? A few of us are actually French, so it's easy, we know the rules. We create two teams, and there is one team with one player short, so I end up playing as a goalie, as a goalkeeper. And you know, we play for 2 hours and it's a lot of fun. Everybody enjoys it, and no more injuries. And the epiphany for me after the kid got hit in the face is I actually realized that they were playing the infinite game. We talk a little bit about infinite game versus finite game. So in gaming, infinite games are basically game with no common rules. So literally the game can change every time, and every time there is a new player joining, well, the rules change and nobody really know the rules. And the probably the most famous infinite game out there is actually business. That's like it's exciting, but at the same time, humans are not designed for infinite game. We are made for finite games. And in fact, actually, as a gaming company, as a game designer, that's pretty much what we do all day. We design rules to turn an infinite game into finite games. So as a player, you know, the first thing as a gamer you do when you start playing a game is to try to understand the rules of the game, so then you know how to win. And if it's a team game, you start to see, okay, how each teammate will actually play a specific role and how you will win the game. But then think of business and think of your business. Like, are you playing a finite or infinite game? And specifically, like, you know, do you know what it takes? Do you and do your teammates know what it takes to win in your business? And if you're playing as a team, do each of your teammates know their role in how we're going to win? And if you wake up in the morning, like, you know, do you know what's going to be your role at winning today? And myself and many people around me, like, if you're exhausted at the end of the day and you feel like you walk a lot, but then you achieved nothing, that's probably because you're actually playing this infinite game. And if you might be confused about the rules and what you're trying to achieve and so on. And as a leader, if I feel like this, that means most likely the people working with me probably feel even more like this. Another sign of playing the infinite game is if you have a lot of traffic controls meeting. What I call a traffic control meeting is typically when a team member comes to you and asks for approval. You know, we have this 3A things, you know, additional clarification, approval, or appraisal. So if a manager all day long, and I've done that as an entrepreneur many, many times, and it's pretty painful, and that's why also I want other people to not have this pain as much as I had in the past. If you play the traffic light meeting guy, that means if all day long you're like, okay, green, you can do it. You know, orange, maybe not. Red, no, you don't do it. If you do that a lot all day long, well, that's probably a sign that you're actually playing an infinite game and that your team actually need more understanding of what is actually their game.
So the way that you're talking about a finite versus an infinite game is really along the lines of understanding the rules or the bounds of the game and the importance to find alignment. So it's less the sort of Simon Sinek, James Karsh version of finite versus infinite games. But I see what you're saying, though, in terms of knowing how to win and aligning the team is kind of what you're saying is important in this case.
Yeah, and the playbook, you have the original playbook, you know, which come with like your vision and your value and your why, you know, why we're doing mm-hmm. this, why we created this company originally.
Right.
And that's something that actually as an investor, I remember, for example, with Lila Games that you have done extremely well. I was very impressed when you've done that at the very start. But then as the game, you know, there is like maybe like five stages in the game development, you know, from the game idea, the formation of the team, the game development, the launch of the game and the live ops. Like while the original playbook is the same, the culture, the value, the why and so on, every time you actually transition from one stage to another, your playbook needs to be adjusted to realign the team. And usually there is also like realignment of the team necessary.
There's a lot of other lessons from your book I need to take into Lila as well, but yeah, for sure.
But the this idea of playbook, actually, this word playbook, it's a kind of a US word, you know, it was actually introduced to me the first time by Nicolas Laurent, who was back then the CEO of Riot Games, League of Legends. Mm-hmm. And he was basically the one planting this seed of playbook, and Riot up to this day has been very, very good at playing the game with a strong playbook.
Right. All right. And maybe just more briefly, that's half the book. And then the other half is revenue, reach, retention. But maybe we could just briefly cover some of those in terms of what you mean by each of those concepts.
Yeah, absolutely. So starting with the revenue, like if you look at the game industry, like most of the game industry right now in terms of revenue is coming from the free-to-play. So mm-hmm. there is a lot of lessons from the game industry and from specifically how to optimize the freemium model. and how to apply the free model to other industry. So part of the revenue chapter, we have a big focus on how to, I call it the ikigai of free, how to actually optimize as you're designing the product, how to optimize your free model. Through the reach is something that, you know, it's every company in every industry wants to have more. How do you reach more customers, more users, and so on? We go through a model that I call OB. OB is for own, buy, and earn. So own is like your own list, like how you actually develop your own list. Earn is, buy is obviously through, you know, buy advertising and so on, through a different way. And earn is like earn your way in. For example, right now, I'm earning my way into your audience through a podcast. That's like the earn part. So we go through each of it and each of the OB, and we explain how gaming company do it and how this can be used better, more within the gaming industry and outside of the gaming industry. And within the retention, well, retention is a lot of focus is on live ops. And that's what I call like the best kept secret in the from the gaming industry. Live ops is majority of the revenue, like 58%, but of the revenue of gaming industry is coming from live ops. But certain company like EA and so on, like it's more like 70-ish% of the revenue is actually coming from live ops. So I develop. Everybody talks about live ops within the gaming industry, but I think it's still lacking a little bit of a common understanding. We talk about playbook. Part of the playbook is also to have common language, common words. So I created in the retention part, I created a framework that I call the love framework that basically introduce to the gaming industry people an acronym and outside of the gaming industry people, what is live ops. And live ops with a love framework, we're talking about live, the L is for live product development. The O is for organized event calendar. The V is for very special sales and offer. and the E is for engagement and re-engagement. Things like churn prevention, churn detection, where a company like Kabam, for example, we talk about in the game, are really good at. And for each, we take example. For example, at Smilegate in the shooter industry, the top performing shooter, talk about Smilegate, yeah, Crossfire, and how they've done it. And yeah, and for each of that, we go through it. So this that's also one of the objectives for me for the gaming industry is within the gaming industry, we have designers, we have producer, we have artists, we have a game developer, networking engineers, et cetera, et cetera. If we start to all have a common understanding of what it takes to actually build this, not just as a game, but as a business, if we start to have common language, then the meeting, the brainstorming, the discussion is a lot easier because, I understand why we're doing this because we're doing live ops through the love framework is, and we want this because we have this organized event calendar that is a big part of what we're doing. So that's this collective wisdom that you mentioned and the endorsement that I got, it's also because we want to kind of crystallize this collective wisdom that maybe was shared between the CEOs and at GDC and around drinks and beers and Slack groups and so on. And we want to make this knowledge available to everyone. So we all have a common understanding of the game. We all have a common language, common wording, common rules, and we play the game better together.
That's great, Ludovic. And I definitely, personally, I haven't finished reading all of the book, but I have read a lot of parts of it, and I did quite enjoy it. So I totally understand why you got the endorsements that you did. It sounds like what one of your objectives is it, besides the things that we talked about, is kind of this notion about creating a common framework. But if you were to think about the one thing you would love for someone in the audience to take away from reading your book, what would that be? What would it be, this common language or kind of applying the lessons learned, or what would mean success for you for a reader to have read your book and to have taken something away from it?
You know, I think as a as an entrepreneur or as anyone working on and being very passionate about making games, like having this a little bit more peace at the end of the day when you go to bed and when you wake up in the morning and so on. I think if Atomic Scaling can bring some of that to the people by bringing them this navigation system. If you feel stressed about everything, well, you can start looking at the 3P, 3R, the navigation system, and you can start seeing, okay, where I maybe need to improve a little bit. And if I improve a little bit here, suddenly, oh, everything feels much better already. And part of the things we do is if you go to atomicscaling.com, we have a quiz where we basically, just in a few questions, we identify like what kind of leadership profile you are. And based on that, we say, okay, this is your strengths, and this is your profile, and this is your strengths, green, and this is maybe on the right side, like, you know, a little bit more red, like this is your things where you're not naturally good at. And based on that, if your strengths are, let's say, aligned with like the profile called we call the dreamer, then you will be very good at playbook, for example. And then how can you be even better at playbook?
I see. Okay.
And if you are maybe not that good at, for example, at prediction, okay, you know it's not your profile, etc. You know that's your weakness. So how can you be slightly better at that? Maybe by having someone in your team who become kind of the guy like really, really, really pushing for it, or also by you paying attention to it. So I think at the end of the day, having this navigation system or this operating system or this navigation system that brings a little bit, not just scaling and wealth and so on, but also a little bit more peace at the end of the day when, you know, when you go to bed or when you wake up in the morning.
Right. It's kind of like what you're talking about is self-awareness, right? So if you are suggesting that a lot of these lessons from the games industry can be applied to achieve success in many different disciplines and industries, and then based upon this collection of lessons or skills, to have this self-awareness about what you are good at. And then if you were to put a team together, what else you would need in order to achieve success?
Yep, exactly.
Great. And I will say, Ludovic, that I think this is a very interesting book. I highly recommend people check it out. But the book I would also recommend that you write next is How to Be a Master Networker. Because again, I'm telling the audience, you gotta see who has endorsed Ludovic's book here. And then some of your blog posts or Instagram, I'm seeing you with all these famous people like Emmanuel Macron and all these other guys. I'm just like, oh my God, Ludovic knows everybody. But anyway. Just want to compliment you on your masterful networking and relationship skills, Ludovic.
Thank you. And thank you for having me today. Okay. It was fun.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And for our audience, hope you enjoy the book and we will catch you next time. Thanks again, Ludovic.